morning. You're listening to Upfront. I'm Kat Brooks. Conversations about mental health are far more public and mainstream than they used to be, especially in supposedly progressive places like the Bay Area. But there is still stigma attached, and those living with mental health issues are forced to navigate systems that are rooted in often oppressive, patient-blaming, and rigid systems that are supposed to heal and not harm. But there's a movement afoot to shift the way mental health is looked at in society and impact the way healing modalities operate. These are some of the things explored in the book We've Been Too Patient. And joining me this morning are the book's editors, L.D. Green and Kelechi Igbozo. Kelechi Igbozo is a Nigerian-American writer and mental health advocate, and L.D. Green is an artivist, a genderqueer writer, performer, college educator, and mental health advocate. Good morning to you both. Thank you for joining me.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So I want to start with the title of the book, We've Been Too Patient. What does that mean, and why is this the title of the book?
Well, it's a pun, because we're impatient with the system, and we've been too patient for too long, and I think we're speaking to the sometimes problematic positioning of people as, like, stuck in a role of patient, and that, like, we talk a lot about peer support and mutual aid in the book and how that can be really transformative to people, and I think sometimes when people are kind of stuck in the role of, like, lifelong patient, there's a message that we'll never get better and that we have to be in that role forever.
Well, and that is often what's said about, you know, certain mental health conditions, anywhere from depression or to other diagnoses, like, you know, being bipolar or other stuff, that you cannot get better, that
right.
You need to be on medication for the rest of your mm-hmm. life. Kelechi, you're rolling your eyes. Why?
Yeah, I'm rolling my eyes because who decided that we were sick or broken or something was wrong with us? You know, we're not always looking at the system that we live in as part of the problem. I mean, we can all take accountability about things that we do, but sometimes our experiences are based in trauma, and trauma can kind of play out in many different ways and then can get labeled as a mental health diagnosis. I definitely myself have had different labels depending on who was, you know, whose mood it was. So I had 5 different diagnoses depending on who was seeing me that day and what they decided it was. And I was like, how do I get help when you said I have bipolar 2, you say I have PTSD, you say I have depression, you say I have ADHD, and each of these carries a different label, a different medication, a different approach, and some of those medications or approaches made me more sick than, at least, than I was in the first place. So I guess what I'm saying is, like, when people say something like, you'll never get better, and that's something I heard when I'm someone who is a suicide attempt survivor, I'm someone who has been in forced treatment, who's been hospitalized, and my first interaction with help was someone saying, you're going to be sick for the rest of your life. And it wasn't until I switched the paradigm and I heard from other people and met other people who had that same experience who were like, no, that's not true. I live a great life. I have family, I have friends, I have a job, I have all these things, however they define success, because it's person defined, not system defined. Then I was like, wait, what is this? What are we being taught? Oh, it's not true. I just don't believe that it's true.
Yeah, and to build on that, that's like one of the, it's like the, we have 2 subtitles to the book, you know, Voices from Radical Mental Health, and then the next part is Stories and Research Challenging the Biomedical Model. I think that's what we're really speaking to here, is this idea of the biomedical model that says that, like what you were just saying, Kat, that, like, you're going to have to be on medication for the rest of your life, you're going to be in therapy for the rest of your life. You have, like, the message of the biomedical model is that there's a chemical imbalance potentially born into a person's brain, and that, as Kelechi was saying, totally erases trauma that can be interpersonal or systemic. And so an alternative to that, well, there's different ways, and we talk about different ways in the book of thinking about it, but one of the alternatives to that is the recovery model, which is what Kelechi was just speaking to, is that you can live a great life. You don't have to, like, resign yourself to this message that you're broken. And I received similar messages when I received a diagnosis at 19. My brain hadn't finished developing at 19. Like, how could someone tell me, like, this is what you're going to be for the rest of your life? You know, like, there is hope, there is transformation. And I like what you said earlier, too, about we get stuck in trauma, you know, and there's ways to transform that that are creative. And we don't give enough space for the exploration of how to heal from trauma. But there's a lot of conversation, I think, that things are shifting. Like, people are recognizing that there's this book, The Body Keeps the Score, that recognizes that trauma influences the brain. and it's not something we're born with. You know, it's systemic. It's the result of violence.
Even within that, at least my personal experience, as a survivor of sexual assault as a child, being told by therapists that I'll never recover from that either.
Right. Totally.
That even acknowledging the trauma, then saying there's no path forward from that, that this will impact you for the rest of your life.
Right. Yeah. I got a message from a therapist once too of like, I was like, okay, so I'm in therapy now. You know, I also have, you know, early childhood trauma. And they were saying like, yeah, you know, you're going to be in therapy for like at least 10, 20 years for this. You know, I'm just like, what's, you know, why are we telling people this? Like, why are we like, if there's enough shame that goes along with experiencing trauma to then say like, I think it gives almost like a message that like, you can't, it takes away agency and it says like, you're going to have to be dependent on this other system and that there's no path forward for you.
And in y'all's work, what kind of exploration has there been around the genesis of this particular, the biomedical model, as the modality to deal with trauma and our mental health issues?
I mean, I think when we approach this work together, I think we came from it from, you know what, we are both people who have had system involvement, who have been taught these messages. And, you know, I will never forget the experience I had when I first moved out to California 7 years ago. And I was at this conference at the Mental Health Association of San Francisco. And they were talking about the challenges or how you need to be careful about the biomedical model. And I heard the story, it still haunts me today, about these researchers and clinicians who went out to visit a nomadic tribe in Africa. And they met someone who had, they had, you know, this person, this gentleman had experience of like seeing things that weren't there, hearing things that weren't there. And the community had accepted him as like having these spiritual gifts. They saw him as someone being spiritual, that he was accepted in their community. And the clinicians took one look at him and said, oh, he's experiencing schizophrenia. He's sick. You should medicate him. Here's the things you need to do. They come back to this tribe maybe 6 months later and they look around to see where the gentleman was. And they're like, where did he go? And they're like, well, you told us he was sick. And in our community, if you're sick, we're a nomadic tribe. We leave the sick behind. So they left that man to die because that is their culture. And they received this Western message that he was sick and there was nothing wrong with him. He had been accepted by his community. He'd been heard. He had been part of that, you know, that ancestor healing. And you have someone in a coat come in and say, you're sick. Like, what is that? That is the biomedical model. Putting a label on someone, limiting them, like ignoring their spiritual gifts. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like that is what we're saying, like, no, that is not, this should not be how we define our experiences. This is why we've been too patient. I could tell you psych ward drama. My goodness, the kind of help I got in psych wards was not helpful at all.
I actually want to go into that.
I'm happy to tell you about that. But I want to just say that this is what we're talking about when we're saying the biomedical model of labeling, displacing someone, ignoring their trauma, ignoring their spirituality, how they heal, not hearing their voice at all, just kind of checking off a box and saying, take this medication. And if the biomedical model worked, why are people more depressed, more unhappy than they've ever been in like the history of mental health? Why are people suffering more?
Right.
If that worked, we should be all frolicking in the streets. We're not.
And consuming more medications for mental health than ever.
Ever.
Yeah. And I wanted to add on to that. Like we talked about the alternative to the biomedical model would be the recovery model. And another way of thinking about it is like to build on like this gentleman who had like spiritual gifts and was revered by his community. There's also that the idea that we talk about in the book of Mad Pride and the idea of dangerous gifts, and that we've been talking recently about wanting to bring the recovery model and the dangerous gifts model together and have them speak to each other. And like
define mad pride and dangerous gifts.
So mad pride is just this idea that like someone's been told that that they have this diagnosis and that means that they're basically subhuman and should be kind of treated with a lot of stigma and like apprehension, you know. And I've experienced that in my life with like my diagnosis of bipolar disorder. People are like, oh, okay, you know. And instead of like taking that shame on, it's like saying, actually, a lot of people with, you know, mental health issues have a lot to offer, you know, like have a lot of sensitivity, have a lot of creativity, and that those are things that we need to tend to and cultivate, not romanticize, but like also just like honor, you know, what those gifts are, and like also try to get better. So that's the conversation that I'm interested in having about how you can have mad pride, but also want to live a healthy life.
Yeah. And the recovery model is more that the person who is receiving treatment, and it's not to say that treatment doesn't help. Like some people have amazing therapists and some people find medication that's helpful for them, right? It's saying that I, as a consumer of mental health services, I lead the charge. I say what works, what doesn't work for me. If you say, do yoga and I hate yoga, that should not be part of my treatment plan. Totally. You should listen to me. I am the driver. If you were to buy anything in the world, the customer's right. But with mental health, it is not the customer is right. Mm. It's you know, we have the authority and we have the knowledge. But I'm like, you know your body.
Right.
No one else is with your body. No one understands yourself more than you. Even when you're struggling and think you don't know, you should be part of every decision. You should be an active decision maker in your care. And that's the recovery model. And also that you can get better. And you get to define what better looks like. You know what I mean? So that's the recovery model. And so sometimes we wish we could just like merge the two. But that's what we were talking about earlier.
And just to what Kelechi was just saying about like it's individual, and that every person has their own idea, you know, we should be in the driver's seat as consumers or like mental health people who are seeking treatment. That reality is that a lot of, like you're saying, like the mental health industrial complex looks at us and says, like, you don't know better. Like there's even a word for it. Like in the foreword, Robert Whittaker talks about anosognosia, I think it's called. It's just that this idea that if someone seeks mental health treatment, they don't understand their own, like, because if they're seen as chemically imbalanced, they're like, that robs them of their agency. They're like, well, you're not rational. You don't have insight. You don't have insight into your own experience. And it's like, we're trying to take that back and say like, no, we do. We know ourselves. And like, we should be the ones to contribute.
That actually is a perfect segue, LD, into where I wanted to go next. Yeah. And that's the ways in which this biomedical model generates violence.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And violence in different ways. And I want to talk about some of the different ways. We've been talking about one, which is robbing people of self-determination, mm-hmm. and their agency.
Mm-hmm.
That's violence.
Mm-hmm.
I want to specifically talk about suicide protocols.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the danger of those, and wrapping my head, and then would love if you're willing to share your own personal experience. Mm-hmm. You'll have to.
No, that's what I'm here for.
But about, you know, someone says they're even thinking about suicide, 72 hours, mandatory. No, in basically a jail that, mm-hmm. just happened to have, yeah. hospital, mm-hmm. beds, and figuring out what tap dance then that you have to do to get this person in this white coat who's known you for 72 hours, yeah. to decide whether or not you're fit to go home or not.
Mm-hmm.
Kelechi.
Yeah, I'm a suicide attempt survivor. I had experiences when I was really young, like 13, and, you know, everyone says, oh, my gosh, that's so young to have those experiences. But to me, you know, I lost my grandmother, and my grandmother was helping to raise me. And like for me, when she died, my world ended. And also, I'm 13. I have no coping strategies. I have not lived enough life to know that things get better. All I know is that this is the lowest moment, and I want it to end. Which, if you think about it, and I'm not, and I don't want to romanticize suicide, I don't. But the experience of feeling alone or isolated, there's nothing crazy about that. If I were to be approached like, wow, no, things can get better, you can heal. If someone were to think, oh, you're having suicidal thoughts, let's have a conversation. But what happens is when you disclose, you get hospitalized. So when I got hospitalized, it was terrifying. I'm 13. I'm in a psych ward. They take away my shoes. You know, they tell me I'm broken. They're like big cots that I'm on with like these bright lights and just watching these other kids. And the only thing I learned from being kind of having this medication and being like kind of drugged into a place where I guess I was like, this is, I guess I feel nothing, so that's better than what I was feeling. No, that wasn't healing. The only thing I learned from the psych ward was how never to go back to a psych ward. So then when I was suicidal later, and I'll give you an example, I would just stuff it down because I was like, you know what? The treatment I'm going to get isn't treatment. It's like you get jailed. Your body is jailed so you don't do anything, so no one is responsible for you. But you don't have conversations. Mm-hmm. You basically are stuck in a place where you kind of do some weird art therapy and maybe you do some group therapy where, like, you know, it's just not helpful. And I will say the last time I went to a psych ward, you know, I was there. I had attempted, and we're watching for movie night, because this is all you do. You watch a movie, you play with some art. For movie night, they're playing Silence of the Lambs, right? Like, you should laugh, because it's right? And I asked the nurse, I'm like, is this an appropriate movie choice for us? And she's like, oh my goodness, you're so high functioning. That's what right? Oh, you know this is messed up? You must be different.
Jesus.
No, this is totally inappropriate. This is the care that we're getting? We're watching Silence of the Lambs in a psych ward, and this is supposed to be helpful? Like, talk about violence. So because I present well as a Black woman and I am able to articulate my trauma or pain, either people don't believe me or they're like, oh, you're so high functioning, you must not be in pain. What if I were to just actually get what I needed, which was a conversation or someone not to lock me away and, mm-hmm. and just say, like, here, take some meds, go away until I think you can revisit the world. That's not what I needed. That wasn't helpful. I needed community, and I needed to not feel alone, and also to know that the experiences I was having, because at that time I had been raped and I was terrified, I needed other people to just talk to me and hold me. But what I got was a sterile environment watching Silence of the Lambs. That did not help my mental health at all. And I'm the one who's seen as crazy. Let's just think about that. I'm the one.
8:30 here on Upfront. We're going to continue our conversation with the editors of this really amazing book, We've Been Too Patient, as alternatives to the traditional mental health model. That's coming up next after these news headlines.
I'm Eileen Alfenderry with KPFA News Headlines. Youth climate campaigner Greta Thunberg told global leaders ecosystems are collapsing and they still haven't come up with solutions commensurate with the task of avoiding climate catastrophe. She accused global leaders of betrayal.
This is all wrong. I shouldn't be up here. I should be back in school on the other side of the ocean. Yet, you all come to us young people for hope. How dare you? You have stolen my dreams and my childhood with your empty words. And yet, I'm one of the lucky ones. People are suffering. People are dying.
The president of the Marshall Islands told the United Nations Climate Summit her low-lying nation faces a special risk.
As president of a low-lying coral atoll nation, I stand before you as a representative of the most climate-vulnerable people on Earth. The summit must be the moment we choose survival over selfishness, communities over coal, and planet over profits. It must be about climate justice.
PG&E may cut power to 124,000 customers in Northern California because of hot, dry, and windy conditions producing high fire danger. PG&E says it will make the decision before noon today. The National Weather Service has issued a red flag fire warning for the North and East Bay Hills and the Diablo Range. The warning is in effect from 9 this evening to 5 o'clock Wednesday morning. Jury selection is set to begin today in an antitrust lawsuit against one of California's largest hospital systems. California Attorney General Javier Becerra and about 1,500 self-funded health plans have sued Sutter Health. Although Sutter is incorporated as a nonprofit, the lawsuit alleges the health giant uses anti-competitive practices to keep prices high. Weather forecast for the San Francisco Bay Area, partly cloudy skies this morning, then sunny and breezy, mid-60s to upper 70s in San Francisco, around 80 along the bay, 90 in the warmest interior valleys. In Fresno and the central San Joaquin Valley, sunny, 87 to 92 degrees. I'm Eileen Alfenderry. More news at 94.1 at 10 on Letters and Politics. Join us at 6 for the Pacifica Evening News.
So what's up with the news? Where is it? News media in a democracy must investigate, inform, maintain an unwavering check on political power. Why doesn't ours? Mickey Huff, director of Project Censored and co-host of the Project Censored show, has co-written with Nolan Higdon, The United States of Distraction, a book that explains exactly how this failure came to be and how to fight back and win. Both authors will appear October 22nd, a Tuesday evening, at 7:30 p.m. at the Hillside Club, 2286 Cedar Street in Berkeley. Escape EFA Benefit Wheelchair Accessible is co-sponsored at Project Censored. Get tickets at brownpapertickets.com or East Bay Indie Bookshops. For Nolan Higdon and Mickey Huff, October 22nd.
You're listening to 94.1 KPFA, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org.
We continue our conversation with Kelechi Obozo and L.D. Green, the editors of We've Been Too Patient, Voices of Radical Mental Health, Stories and Research Challenging the Biomedical Model. The criminalization of mental health is also a byproduct of this biomedical model. Over half of the people that are killed by law enforcement are in the middle of a mental health crisis, vast majority unarmed, almost all of them, as a matter of fact. Any thoughts about the criminalization of mental health and the use of the carceral state to deal with mental health?
Yeah, I can talk about both things. So one of the things is if you're a person of color, you know, many of our communities have been traumatized by the police. There's just not another way to say that.
All of them.
All of them, right? And when someone's in a mental health crisis, why is it that that is the option is to call 911? Because that's the last thing you should do, at least in my experience. I'd have to really be, I know what happens. We've lost people in our communities because they were having a mental health crisis and they looked what scary to someone and they get killed because they needed mental health treatment and support that doesn't look like the biomedical model. I think that's one thing. And most of our folks who have mental health issues are receiving treatment in jails. That's where people are getting their mental health treatment. They didn't need to ever be in jail. They needed help, but they get the treatment in jails. It's run with people of color. That's what we're getting. It's like, oh, here you go. Here's some jail mental health treatment. Mm-hmm. Again, this is, and then you're criminalized for the rest of your life. That is on your record. That is who you are. That's how you're labeled. And why you shouldn't have even been in that system. Much like many of us shouldn't be in the system anyways, but especially not for mental health conditions or experiences. And I will say something that has been controversial. It gets me in a lot of trouble, but I do want to...
This is the show for all of us.
Right? It gets me in a lot of trouble. A lot of people don't like when I talk about it, but I do talk about, in my work, and so I'm a mental health advocate, and I'm also a researcher, and I researched and I did work in Black communities because there is this lie that suicide doesn't happen in Black communities. They think that people who are, Black don't have mental health crisis or do not experience suicidology. And I went to San Bernardino and talked to a group down there about how suicide shows up in the Black community. And they said, yeah, it shows up. It's just blue suicide. And I was like, what do you mean? And they're like, suicide by cop. We know they'll kill us. And so we purposely, sometimes some people purposely antagonize the police as a way to die. And that is never going to show up in data. That's never going to, barely shows up in homicide. Those numbers will never show up. But if you're using that, which is sick, for that, that is an option for suicide. That's a way to get out of here. Like, that speaks so much about where we are and what our world looks like. But again, that also erases our stories that this is something that is an experience in our communities. And we're taught not to talk about it. We're taught to keep secrets. And I don't know, I think secrets keep us isolated and feeling worse. But there's this huge culture of you got to be strong. And I think strength can look like reaching out. But so many of us do not reach out. And because what is there to reach out to if we are not providing the support? Because if you're reaching out to what I got, I could see why you wouldn't reach out.
Well, in our communities, Black communities in particular, we were taught to not let the white people see anything about us because it got us killed, right? And that plays out when we're talking about sexual assault. It plays out with mental health. Mm-hmm. It plays out with all of these things. And the only thing I would say about blue suicide is that I don't want to let the cops off the hook.
No.
Because even if in some cases, that's what's happening. It is the job of law enforcement to not kill unarmed people of color. Yeah,
absolutely. Right? Absolutely.
But that's a good segue, too, because I want to talk about some intersectionality stuff. So I want to talk about the intersectionality of race and mental health care and the differences that can play out, you know, if you happen to be a person of color versus someone that's white. And I also want to talk about when you bring, talk about the intersection of LGBTQ plus identities and mental health care and the way that that plays out. So either one of you can start.
So I'll just speak, you know, from my experience. So I think that there really does not, there does need to be a lot more training as well as from, with therapists around, in particular for trans and gender nonconforming folks. There's a lot of, you know, ignorance around that. And, you know, just recently I had a therapist who was, who did not really respond well, you know, when I came out to her as being gender non-binary. And she, yeah, she didn't handle it well. And I feel like there needs to be a lot more training. I mean, even in the Bay Area, you know, like there's
I said supposedly progressive.
Yeah, you know, and I feel like it's really disappointing, and that was really damaging to lose that relationship just even recently. And I think that, I think something one of our panelists said in New York, who is actually trans femme as well, was speaking to this issue that we have to be honest that people who are seeking professionalization as social workers, as therapists, are predominantly going to be folks who have more privilege. Like, that's just like who's generally seeking certification. There's not going to be as many trans therapists. Like, we can't like expect that to happen. There are some, but we need structures where there's people who are being trained. And that speaks to different intersections as well. Like, we definitely would love to have more people of color therapists, more LGBT therapists, and we can have a certain amount of those, and we maybe have some privilege of that in the Bay Area to have that access. But to the extent that a lot of the people seeking those professional degrees don't have that lived experience of being on the margins, there need to be more trainings for folks to get sensitivity training, and people need to seek that out through their certification process as they like renew their certifications and stuff like that.
Colette, race and mental health. The angry, crazy black woman.
Yeah. Angry, crazy, frustrated. I mean, I've not gotten what I needed until I received support from, and I will say that I've had really good experiences and really bad experiences, so I want to be careful, but I will say that, like, a lot of times my experience isn't understood, and I'm lucky to have finally gotten access to another, you know, African-American woman who provides care, so that I can talk about what goes on at work, for example, about privilege and about white fragility that I'm supposed to somehow navigate. And those things impact my mental health. You know, we're not just talking about, like, you know, surviving an assault. I'm talking about, like, every day living in this world, dealing with structural racism, dealing with favoritism, dealing with trying to navigate identity at work. I need someone who is part of my identity to connect with.
Right.
Because I can't have that conversation with a white woman sitting in a chair. I can't do that. And so there are not enough.
Yes.
There are not enough African-American. There are not enough people of color who can get access to all of the, I mean, all of the loans you need to actually go through the process to become a professional therapist. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of hours. And then when you go through it, the things that you're taught, they almost teach the black out of you. You know, I've seen this with some of my friends who are in the work right now, who are currently getting trained, and they're getting trained in a way that they were trying to go in there to change things, but what they're learning isn't changing anything. So they're basically just learning the biomedical model in the way that it's been imposed for years. And so I'm like, if you know that spirituality is important, if you know that, like, connecting to your ancestors is important, like, that's not like a class that you take. You know what I mean? There's not like a Therapy 101, how do you reach black folks? Like, they just aren't doing that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's also why it's important. When we say peer support, I'm talking about people who receive training, who are like us, because we're never going to have enough therapists. We just aren't.
Right.
But we can also take it on ourselves. We can get training. Other people who are like us can work with each other.
What kind
to support
of training?
Each other. So I'm talking about cultural competency training, but I'm also talking about using your experiences as a survivor, having boundaries, whatever that experience is, using that experience to help others in the recovery process. I learned more being lifted up around by other people like me, especially other black women who acknowledged that they had mental health issues, talked about what their experiences were like, and brought me up with them. And that's some of the what we call the mental health consumer movement. There are agencies out here who are consumer run. So they're run by people who have mental health experiences. Peers is a good example. They're in Oakland, Peers Envisioning and Engaging in Recovery Services. Their executive director is also a black woman who has been in the foster care system. And everyone's open about their experiences and trauma, but that's not their whole label. And that in itself is powerful. We're not hiding. So I think what I'm saying is that I it is important for other people to get training. It is. But there's something really powerful about someone else kind of witnessing you and seeing you and understanding and help lifting. And other communities, depending on what culture you are, even saying mental health at all, like, ooh, my goodness, you have to run away. You can't talk about it yet. And I don't know, we're going to change years of culture, but how do you approach it? Like, I did some work in the Chinese community, and it wasn't appropriate for me to even be in the room in many cases. So I'm working with someone else, working with someone else. But what ended up happening was, you know, people wouldn't openly speak about their mental health issues, but they would talk about how things were interrupting their meditation. So then it was focused more on, okay, you're more focused on your body right now, or at least this group of folks were like, I can talk about what's interrupting my sleep. I can talk about what's interrupting my well-being like that, and that feels safe for me. So disclosing all of your challenges in this, you know, and having these stories might be okay for one community, might not work for another, but they need to be the drivers, because I don't know what's going to work for your community. I'll just say what worked for me. And, you know, if I'm labeled as an angry black woman again, you know, I have the right to be angry, and I can embrace it. And I mean, who wouldn't be angry at the system? But there's nothing wrong with us. We have just taken on too much, put too much on our shoulders, been taught that strong meant taking care of everyone else but ourselves. So if we could shift the paradigm to also think of ourselves as people that we should take care of, then I think that could do some healing. But there ain't nothing wrong with us except for taking care of everybody but ourselves.
As mental health advocates and also as people living with mental health issues, when you see the orange dude.
Oh, Lord.
45. Talk about gun violence and white supremacy as mental health issues. What happens for you?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, and that is coming up.
A lot right now.
Yeah, people are saying that, and that's very disturbing to me and frustrating. First of all, I think it's important to highlight that people with mental health issues are far more likely to be victims of violence than perpetrators of violence, and that's part of stigma, and it's so dangerous to use that rhetoric. And he's actually saying things, too, about building more institutions for folks, which, as someone who's been in psych wards, that's a horrible thing to have thrown around, is like this idea that people need to be locked up forever, you know, like, and just this new frontier of what he's talking about like bringing back this really regressive idea of where people with, you know, mental differences should go. And it's terrifying. And then also, of course, that he's conflating and, you know, making this horrible scapegoat of people who are struggling and making that the issue rather than white supremacy and the rhetoric that he promotes.
I think what comes up for me is that, you know, I don't see toxic masculinity and white privilege in the DSM, in the book of mental illness. But that's what's going on right here.
Well, that's the book we should write.
Right. I mean, I don't believe the biomedical
Next
model. Next project. DSM. I'm like, that is that one of these things is always like the other. That is consistent. Why don't you look at who's doing things and what they look like in their experience? If I hear, you know, I feel like sometimes people think that evil equals mental health issues. It's yeah. that what is happening is evil. That is not a mental health issue. Mm-hmm. That's just evil. And it really enrages me and hurts my heart that even more people who have mental health issues are now more likely to not talk about it because of this rhetoric, which is why we have to stay strong and say what our stories are and say our truth, because what's going on out there is evil and toxic and white supremacy and toxic masculinity and privilege. That is what's going on.
Mm-hmm. You're both artists, artivists. Talk about the role of art in radical mental health and this alternative pathway to healing.
Well, as we were talking about how we wanted to approach this project, we met in a writing space. We met at Liminal, which is a feminist and womanist writing space in Oakland, and did poetry together. Mm-hmm. So I think we had this idea that we really wanted to highlight voices and stories. And that's one of the most important things in the book is this idea of the power of narrative. You know, it's powerful for the teller to heal and transform. And as the personal is political, the stories and poems in our book humanize people with mental health struggles who are so often stigmatized. But I think, beyond that, we're also offering counter narratives, because I think a lot of times in the media and in Hollywood, there's this idea that we're given a message all the time that what's the mainstream story, and it can work for some people. Like we talk about having a diagnosis and having a plan within the biomedical model can work for some people, but it doesn't work for a lot of us. And we're offering a different story, because a lot of people, the story that's offered in the media is you exhibit symptoms, whatever those are. You go to the doctor, they give you your pills, and you swallow your pride along with your pills, and then you're better. And, the sun sets, and that's the story, that's for many of us, it's a much more difficult path. And the path towards finding healing is much more curving and winding through the woods, and we just have to make our own way, and it's a process of discovery. And the voices in this book really highlight that healing is an individual journey. It's not cookie cutter. It's not just go to the doctor and get fixed. It's a spiritual journey. It's a creative journey. It's a journey with many diverse voices. So that's what we're trying to highlight in the book.
Yeah, and I would say for me, when I was going through there's been some peaks and some valleys, but when I was having one of those valleys, being creative, I think, is what was one thing that just helped save my life. I was just in a really tough time, called off my engagement, had the person who had attacked me years ago contact and find out where I worked, which was the most terrifying thing ever. So I just was in this kind of state of trauma, and seeing things like that art exhibit, The Black Woman is God, oh my gosh, so beautiful, just really lifted my spirits. Writing was really helpful, and I'm not gonna lie, I was in that Nick's karaoke bar maybe 7 days a week because I needed to sing, but I was singing sad songs, but I needed to get stuff out of my body, and that's how I feel about writing and singing. I needed to exercise some of the things that were it just felt like it was trapped in there, and it needed an audience. And sometimes I got a lovely audience of people who would listen either to my story or to my poetry, and I can hide it in poetry, but everyone's like, yeah, I know that's you, and feel that connectivity and also just release it. And for me, creativity is part release and so much healing. And also connecting with other people who are that happened to me too, which is the worst experience, but also the experience that doesn't make me feel isolated, is that I'm not the only person with this story. I might be one who talks about it, but I'm not alone. So there is a whole community of people when you are able to be an artist to express that, and I've seen you express your art. I mean, and that was a beautiful gift too, though I did cry a lot after that play. But yeah, that's just been something really important.
What is your hope for this book?
Well, something I was alluding to earlier, and we were talking about on the phone before the interview, is that this is a movement that's actually been going on for a long time in the margins, and people aren't talking about what we're contributing in the mainstream. I think this book, we highlight Nothing About Us, Without Us, and this book is like people who, it's all people with lived experience. And there's people in the book who disagree with each other. And so, and I think that's okay. And I hope this book is a conversation starter for folks who are already in the movement or different corners of the movement and can advance what needs to happen to make change happen in within systems and outside of systems. I also hope that it reduces stigma and gets people to have different ideas about people in their family and reaches people who are struggling with mental health and offers a different path forward for them. And so, you know, they don't have to accept the narrative that has been given to them as like the only way forward.
Kelechi.
I hope that it touches people and that it's a beacon of hope and just can open conversations. And I hope communities of color and our folks who are intersectional, you know, experience intersectionality, being in different groups, can also connect with each other and see themselves. I want people to see themselves in this book, because it really includes so many people and their families. Lastly, I would really hope that, you know, just in addition to what LD said, really reducing stigma. I want this to be the beginning of a conversation, not the end. This is our system is really broken. The system, not the people. So everyone has a part to play, and I hope people pick this up and figure out what their part to play is, because it's not too small. Anyone can show up and be a human and just do better and accept. So that's what I hope.
You mentioned that there are places where people can get treatment, help, however they want to define it, outside of the biomedical model. You mentioned peers. Are there other resources that listeners should know about that they can access?
Yeah, I would say, you know, there are warm lines, which I don't have the number, but maybe we can send you later. But Mental Health Association of San Francisco has a warm line, and it's run by people who have lived experience of mental health issues. So you can call. You don't have to be in a crisis. If you just want to talk to someone when you're struggling, that's really, really helpful. BRL, Beats Rhymes Life, they've always been a really awesome organization. They approach mental health through music, and they don't say at-risk youth, but they work with at-promise youth. And so they work with folks and kind of hear their stories and turn it into, like, beautiful art. And I'm trying to think of others.
Can jump in with
Yeah.
Me. Yeah, so something that's been very influential in my life as far as developing my sense of mad pride and dignity is the Icarus Project, and that was founded in 2002 with Jax McNamara and Sasha Altman de Brule, who are both in the book. And so it's taken many shapes and forms over the years, but it's like a worldwide movement at this point, and there are chapters all over the country, some globally, with folks getting together to talk about lived experience and having mad pride together. And I was part of that Bay Area chapter for a couple years. And I think folks, because of this book, people are kind of, it's like reawakening, and something might start taking shape locally. So be on the lookout for like, not necessarily the Icarus Project. It might take a new transformation, but like, check out, our events. We have events coming up. We should plug those.
Go for it.
So we have September 9th is Moondrop Productions. And then we can check our website for locations, which is we've been2patient.org. September 22nd, we'll be on the Mental Health Comedy Hour, which should be interesting.
Yeah.
And then October 15th, we have an event at Litquake, and that'll be in Oakland. So come out to these events in the Bay, you know, locally, start having these conversations with us. The Litquake event will have a panel and a long Q&A. So things are percolating, and like, just be on the lookout. And the Icarus Project still has a website that we can check out, whether an education project and a space that questions really the biomedical model, and like, it's for people who are given the label of mentally ill but want to challenge what that means. So it's the IcarusProject.net.
Yeah, and our contributors, just want to shout out to them, because we have so many people in this book with research and their own experiences. They talk about spirituality. They talk about surviving suicide. They also talk about what's been helpful. What does the recovery movement look like? So, you know, we're talking about a book, but we're talking about a collection of humans.
Yes.
So it's not a, you know, it's a very living, thriving organism, if you will.
Yeah, and like, read their bios, check out their work, you know, yeah.
All right. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining me this morning.
Thank you for having us.
You are listening to Upfront. I'm Kat Brooks. I have been in conversation with Kelechi Ubozo, a Nigerian-American writer and mental health advocate, and L.D. Green, an artivist, a genderqueer writer, performer, college educator, and mental health advocate, about the book, The Living Organism, that is in book form. We've been two patient voices from radical mental health stories and research challenging the biomedical model.